Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today we're looking into something really crucial and often quite difficult, the relationship between Yazidis and non-Yazidi Kurds. And importantly, we're focusing on the time before all the major crises that hit the headlines in the last decade or so, really before 2013, maybe even thinking back before 2010.
Exactly. The goal here is to try and grasp the historical baseline. You know, what were the dynamics like on the ground? What were the vulnerabilities?
And what about trust? Was there trust, or maybe more critically, a long-standing lack of trust already baked in?
Right. Before huge events like the 2014 ISIS genocide really brought the Yazidis to global attention, we've been going through quite a collection of documents, research that focuses specifically on this earlier period.
To sort of uncover that foundation.
Precisely. And the first thing that jumps out is this. Well, it's almost a paradox, isn't it?
How so?
You have this shared language. The vast majority of Yazidis speak Kurmanji, the main northern Kurdish dialect.
Right, and it's not just everyday speech. Kurmanji is actually the liturgical language for Yazidis, the language of their ancient religious traditions, passed down orally for centuries.
Which is a really significant tie. For people who argue for a shared Kurdish identity, that linguistic connection is a key piece of evidence.
But, and it's a huge but.
It is. The profound difference, the thing that really set them apart and tragically became a source of conflict for centuries, is religion. Yazidism is unique.
How so?
Well, the research describes it as a syncretic, monotheistic faith. Its roots are incredibly deep, likely predating both Islam and Christianity. It seems to weave together elements from all sorts of ancient traditions, you know, pre-Zoroastrian beliefs, Zoroastrianism itself, Manichaeism, maybe influences from Judaism, Nestorian Christianity, even Islamic Sufism, a real mosaic.
And it was this distinct faith, specifically their reverence for Tawusi Melek, the peacock angel, that was just so tragically misunderstood by their neighbors.
Profoundly misunderstood, including by Muslim Kurds. And this led to that incredibly damaging, persistent label of devil worshippers.
Which wasn't just name-calling.
Oh, absolutely not. It became the ideological justification, the excuse for centuries of prejudice and just horrific violence against them.
Which brings us right to the identity question itself. And the sources make it clear. This isn't simple. It wasn't just outsiders debating it. It was, and still is, debated within the Yazidi community.
That's such a crucial point. Some Yazidis, you see this particularly in Iraqi Kurdistan, do identify strongly as ethnically Kurdish. Think of figures like Vian Dakhil, the Yazidi MP in Iraq. She actively opposed separating Yazidis from the Kurdish ethnic group.
And the KRG, the Kurdistan regional government, often promoted that view, didn't they? Sometimes framing Yazidis as the original Kurds.
Exactly. The idea being they represent the pre-Islamic roots of the Kurdish people. It serves a narrative.
But then you have the other side of that coin.
You do, especially if you look at Yazidi communities in the Caucasus, like in Armenia or in the diaspora across Europe. There you find a very strong assertion of a distinct Yazidi ethnicity, a separate nationality.
And for some in that group, the feeling goes deeper, right? Like seeing Muslim Kurds as having sort of betrayed an older shared faith by converting.
Yes, precisely. While Yazidis see themselves as having kept the ancient path, you had figures like Aziz Tamoyan in Armenia, very vocal, arguing for a Yazidi nation in Izdiki language, the Sharfaddin religion distinct entities.
The sources even mention Yazidi mythology about being descended only from Adam, not Eve, which kind of underlines that sense of separateness.
It does. So this internal debate, this fundamental question of who are we? It wasn't just academic. The research shows how it became politicized, almost a commodity used by different powers.
Right. Kurdish nationalists, for instance, used the original Kurds idea strategically. Why? Well, it helped bolster their claims to territory, boosted their demographic arguments for a larger Kurdistan, more numbers, more weight.
Makes sense.
But then you had the complete opposite from Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime in Iraq. Arabization. Exactly. Systematic policies, destroying Yazidi villages, forcing people into collective towns, making them register as Arabs in the census. The aim was clear. Break up Kurdish areas, fragment any opposition, deny their numbers.
And things shifted again after 2003 when the KRG gained more influence in those northern areas.
Yeah, the sources document significant pressure then on Yazidis to identify as Kurds. Human Rights Watch reported on intimidation, arbitrary arrests by KRG forces targeting Yazidis who didn't toe the line, who maybe identified differently or criticized KRG policies.
It gets darker, too. There were serious allegations documented in some reports about torture, about ultimatums, basically identify as Kurdish or be labeled a terrorist.
I remember reading Prince Tahsin Said Ali, their spiritual leader, reportedly warned U.S. officials it felt existential, this pressure, like the community could just vanish like snow in the sunshine, was the quote, I think.
A chilling phrase. And add to that identity pressure, the documented cases, post-2003, of abduction and forced marriage of Yazidi women to members of Kurdish security forces.
Which, given these strict Yazidi religious rules about marrying within the faith...
It was a direct assault, not just a crime, but an attack on their very identity, their community's future, often forcing these women to convert and identify as Kurdish.
So looking back before 2014, it's clear. For many Yazidis, the word Kurd itself became incredibly loaded, often inseparable from Muslim.
And weighted down by centuries of trauma, centuries of persecution, it created this perceived divide rooted in religion, making any simple idea of a unified Kurdish identity really problematic and leaving trust, well, extremely fragile.
And that fragility wasn't theoretical. It was forged in real violence.
A long, tragic history of it, often carried out by their Muslim neighbors, including Kurds. This history is seared into Yazidi memory as the Firmans.
Which means basically decrees of extermination, campaigns of annihilation.
That's the weight it carries, yes. And this goes way back. The sources aren't just talking about the 20th century. We see reports from the 10th century Islamized Kurdish tribes involved in persecuting Yazidis in the Hakkari Mountains.
Wow, that early.
Yeah. Then in 1254... Badr al-Din Lulu, a Kurd, who became governor of Mosul after converting, he executed Sheikh Adi's grandnephew and hundreds of followers, desecrated the holy site at Lalish.
And Lalish was attacked again later.
It was. Burned in 1415, another attack in Sinjar in 1585 by Sunni Kurds from Bhutan. But the 19th century, that period really stands out in the sources as particularly brutal.
Just relentless massacres and forced conversion.
Absolutely devastating. Muhammad Pasha of Rawandus, known as Mire Kor, the blind prince, his campaigns between 1831 and 1833 were notoriously savage.
The details are just horrific. Massacres in places like Kelik, Katara, Akra, Sinjar, occupying hundreds of Yazidi villages.
And kidnapping thousands, maybe 10,000 people, giving them that stark choice, convert to Islam or die. Most were forcibly converted, others killed. He also killed the Yazidi prince Ali Beg, which was a huge blow.
And he wasn't the only one inflicting that level of violence. Bidir Khan Beg of Bhutan.
Right. Implicated alongside Mire Kor. Some sources estimate maybe 70,000 Yazidis killed around 1832 between them. Bidir Khan's forces carried out this awful massacre in Shaykhan, almost wiped out the Yazidis there. People drowned fleeing across the Tigris, maybe 12,000 killed just on the riverbanks. Women, children, systematically kidnapped.
And he led another campaign later in Terebdin.
Yes, 1844, more massacres, more forced conversions, 7 entire villages forced to convert. Some historical reports actually classify these 19th century massacres as genocidal. The scale, the intent...
Did the Yazidis resist?
They tried. The sources mention Prince Ali Beg mobilizing forces, but they were just consistently outnumbered, outgunned, facing larger, better equipped forces.
And incredibly, the persecution didn't stop even when they got some legal recognition from the Ottomans later in the 19th century.
No. In the 1890s, you have Ottoman General Omar Wabi Pasha demanding conversions. Refusal led to massacres, destruction of temples, and in a deeply symbolic act of violation, they seized Lalish, the most sacred site, and turned it into a Quranic school for 12 years.
And the Ottomans used Kurdish forces in this too.
Frequently. The Hamidi cavalry, often made up of Kurdish tribesmen, were used to attack Yazidi villages like Bashika and Bazani. They enforced state policy, repressed dissent. The Yazidi leader, Mir Ali Beg, was captured and exiled during this period.
This pattern just continues into the early 20th century.
Tragically, yes. During the Armenian Genocide, 1915-1916, many Yazidis were also targeted and killed. And again, the perpetrators included those Hamidi cavalry units and other Kurdish groups involved in the atrocities against Christians.
There were those chilling slogans, weren't there? Similar to those used against Armenians.
Yeah, things like, kill 7 Yazidis, go to heaven. Some estimates suggest maybe up to 300,000 Yazidis killed or displaced during that whole horrific period.
So this history, these pheromones, this wasn't just isolated incidents. It was systemic, religiously motivated violence, often by Muslim Kurdish neighbors.
creating this profound collective trauma, it's absolutely central to understanding Yazidi identity and memory. It inevitably shaped how they perceived Kurds often as historical persecutors.
And while the religious justification calling them heretics or devil worshippers was key,
it was often intertwined with very real political and economic motives, as the sources show. Seizing land, remember those hundreds of occupied villages. Consolidating power. It wasn't purely religious hatred, but a devastating mix.
Ooh, that's a lot to take in. A heavy history.
It truly is.
Oh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbosh Hannah.
Rojbosh Hannah. Perfect timing.
Okay, let's see. Sips. How's yours? Mine feels maybe a bit sharp today.
Sips thoughtfully. You know, I think you're right. It does have a bit of a bite. Maybe it could use just a touch more sugar. Or perhaps it's just the heavy topic making it taste that way.
Huh. Could be. Definitely needs a little something, though. Thanks, Hannah.
Yeah.
All right, just a quick moment for chai.
Okay.
Okay, let's pick back up. So beyond that deeply troubled history of conflict, the sources also emphasize how Yazidi political experiences really varied before 2010. It depended hugely on which country they lived in, right? Mm. And the Kurdish political groups active there.
Exactly. State policies weren't just background noise. They actively shaped things. Sometimes, yes, creating shared problems with Kurds against a state oppressor, but often making tensions worse or pushing Yazidis down different identity paths altogether.
Let's start with Iraq, especially after 2003, but before things really escalated around 2010. Yazidis were mostly in those disputed territories, like Sinjar, Sheikhan.
In Minawa Governorate, these became contested zones between Baghdad and the KRG.
And the failure to sort out Article 140 that planned to resolve their status
left communities like the Yazidis completely vulnerable, caught in the middle as the KRG extended its de facto control, its influence, into those areas.
And as we mentioned, the KRG influence was a double-edged sword.
Absolutely. On one hand, yes, the KRG funded some Yazidi groups, tried to co-opt leaders, but then the darker side, intimidation, arrests by KRG security, that constant pressure to identify as Kurdish, silencing dissent, those really disturbing allegations of torture.
Yet, paradoxically, for some Yazidis before 2014, the KRG Peshmerga presence did feel like a source of security, didn't it?
It did, which shows the incredibly difficult bind they were in. Needing protection, but the potential protectors were also a source of pressure, sometimes outright suppression.
And before 2003, under Saddam.
Systematic Arabization, village destruction, forced resettlement in government towns, pressure to register as Arabs, all aimed at weakening the Kurdish presence.
But even with that oppression, some Yazidis did still support the Kurdish movement back then.
They did. And it's interesting, Yazidis were largely spared the direct genocidal violence of the Anfal campaign in the late 80s, which targeted Kurds further south. That added another layer of complexity to their relationship with the broader Kurdish struggle.
Politically, they were historically marginalized. Post-2003, representation improved a bit, but often seemed tied to KRG affiliation.
Right, and that single seat in the Iraqi parliament was often seen as just part of the Kurdish bloc. Some Yazidis worried Article 140 might end up erasing their specific rights as a distinct minority.
Okay, moving over to Turkey. Yazidis there face pressures from the Turkish state itself, but also complex relations with the Kurdish population. That history, 1844, 1915, 16.
Cast a long shadow, definitely. And in modern Turkey, especially before 2010, they faced huge hardships, political, religious, economic, leading to massive emigration, particularly after the 1980 coup.
Plus, the Turkish state's general suppression of Kurdish identity would have hit Kurmanji-speaking Yazidis hard, too.
Without doubt. And in the diaspora, say Germany, the sources mention these internal Yazidi debates assert a totally separate identity or align with Kurdish groups, some linked to the PKK. It was contentious.
What about Syria before 2011?
Similar story of state discrimination against Kurds generally under the Ba'athists. That 1962 census stripping citizenship from thousands, including Yazidis, was brutal. Statelessness.
But the sources point to specific religious discrimination against Yazidis there too, right?
Critically, yes. Denied basic religious rights, couldn't build or renovate temples, forced Islamic education in schools, and crucially, they were officially registered as Muslims by the state.
Wow. So forced under Sharia law.
Exactly. Leading to coercive assimilation. A double whammy. Ethnic and religious persecution.
How did they interact with Syrian Kurdish movements before 2011? The sources seem less clear on that.
Yeah, groups like the PYDYPG really became major players after 2011. Before that, it's less documented. You can infer shared grievances against the state, sure, but that historical trauma with Muslim Kurds elsewhere, it likely influenced trust levels even then.
And finally, the Caucasus, Armenia, Georgia. A different trajectory again.
Somewhat. Many Yazidis there were descendants of those fleeing Ottoman persecution, often involving Kurdish groups. The Soviet era was mixed. Some support for Kurmanji initially, but fluctuating census policies and official atheism ignored religion.
But post-Soviet Armenia saw a strong push for distinct Yazidi identity.
Very strong. Separate from Kurds. The Armenian state even recognized Yazidi as a language. Georgia, though, tended to still classify them as Kurds.
And they faced common problems there.
Yes. Lack of state support for culture, religion, language, economic hardship, discrimination, limited political voice, especially concerns about native language education declining in Georgia.
So across the board, state policies were really active players, weren't they? Sometimes pushing people together against the state, but often driving wedges, creating different paths.
Absolutely. Different states, different pressures, different Kurdish actors. It led to very varied experiences for Yazidis, likely fragmenting the community to some degree globally.
Given all that conflict and pressure, it's easy to just focus there. But the sources do say it wasn't only violence, right? There were times of coexistence.
That's important to remember, yes. It wasn't monolithic. Yazidis lived alongside Muslim neighbors, including Kurds, and peaceful cohabitation definitely happened locally.
And historically, some integration.
There were periods where Yazidism was embraced by Kurdish tribes, even became the religion of some Kurdish emirates, like Botan. Sherif Khan Bedlisi, the 16th century Kurdish historian, listed Yazidi tribes, suggesting they were part of the wider Kurdish tribal scene back then.
They shared livelihoods too, right? Farming, herding.
Which meant economic interaction. Trade, markets, land access, they were part of the regional economy. Although forced displacement, like Arabization, obviously disrupted that massively.
Were there actual alliances?
Yes. Specific examples come up. Under the Ayyubids, who were Kurdish Yazidis, served as soldiers, ambassadors, got land grants. That suggests real high-level cooperation.
Interesting.
They also made pragmatic alliances with other regional powers, like Turkoman groups. And more recently, you see that mutual support Yazidis sheltering Armenians during the genocide.
Hiding alongside Armenians at Sardarpat in 1918.
A key moment. And making common cause with local Christians in Tur Abdin or Sinjar against shared enemies at different times.
So these moments happened. But were they deep or more about practical needs?
That's the question the sources raise. Often, it seems driven by pragmatism, shared economy, common threats. It might not have fundamentally shifted that deep mistrust born from the pheromones. That long memory of violence likely remained the dominant undercurrent for many.
And things changed in the 20th century anyway, with states and parties becoming more involved.
Right. Modernization, detribalization, interactions became less purely local. More mediated by institutions, parties like KDP, PUK, nationalism, new pressures, new dynamics.
So wrapping this up, what the sources really show is this incredibly complex picture before 2010, this duality. Shared language, some culture, but profound religious difference.
And overshadowed by that immense traumatic legacy of the Fermans, creating deep, persistent mistrust.
Yazidi identity itself was constantly contested, politicized, caught between state assimilation and different forms of Kurdish nationalism, sometimes coercive.
And their experiences varied so much depending on the country, adding another layer of complexity.
Which created this constant, dangerous security dilemma. Need protection. It often comes with pressure to give up your identity, assert your distinctness, risk isolation.
Exactly. A lack of any consistently trusted entity for security without strings attached. And that whole intricate, precarious situation, the vulnerability, the contested identity, the deep mistrust being caught between powers that was the essential, fragile backdrop to 2014.
Understanding this before, this baseline, is just so vital. It gives you the context for the Yazidi experience during and after the genocide. It explains the responses, the complex relationships, the ongoing struggles.
It shows why trust was already broken, why vulnerability was so high, why identity was already such a raw nerve long before ISIS arrived in Sinjar.
So it's something for you, the listener, to perhaps reflect on. How do communities even begin to balance shared cultural ties with fiercely held distinct identities, especially when historical trauma is so deeply woven into their story?
And thinking about what happened before 2014, what does the Yazidi experience tell us about what's truly needed to protect vulnerable minorities in these incredibly volatile parts of the world today? What are the real preconditions for safety and dignity?
Thank you for joining us here at the Curtis Research Audio Archive.